Well, we're in the month of November, and we're going to do part two of birthdays. But first, I know of the most important birthday in recent days. On Friday, as a matter of fact, the 8th, Nathan Brave French was born. Do you know who that guy is?
Potential welfare recipient? No.
My daughter had a baby on Friday, and Nathan Brave French was 9 pounds. He was a big boy, and he was born in the month of November, and I'm going to add one other thing, that my daughter, Rena, who just had the baby, her birthday is on the 19th. So two in November, two winners in November. I don't know how you're going to top that.
Well, it's obviously impossible, and we should just quit recording the show right now.
All right, thank you very much, and God bless. Good night. Yeah.
However, there are a few unimportant people, comparatively unimportant people, with birthdays this week. A few days ago was the birthday of Vachel Lindsay, now almost completely unknown. Vachel Lindsay was at one point in the early 20th century among the most distinguished residents and citizens of Illinois. Lindsay was a poet who wrote such poems as General William Booth Enters into Heaven and The Congo. I think maybe the poem The Congo is why he's not much read. He was big on performance art, you know, sort of. You would love him, Rex, because he would come out and recite in a big voice, and he had all sorts of sort of sound effects he made with his voice. He was quite an eccentric character, a real American populist type. Lindsay traveled the highways and byways of the Middle West preaching the gospel of beauty. And he would hand out a little pamphlet called Rhymes for Bread to a farmer and say, I'll give you this book if you'll give me a place to sleep or a dinner. And then he wrote a book, one of the most unusual books written by an American, called Adventures Preaching the Gospel of Beauty.
Gospel of Beauty. Yes. I thought you meant the gospel,
no,
but it's a different gospel.
His good news was you didn't have to live in squalor and ugliness. Your life could be beautiful if you would only look at your life in the right way. Imagine telling this to an Illinois dirt farmer, or imagine telling it to somebody working on the Chicago Board of Trade today. I mean, they love ugliness. So, so that was the 10th. On the 12th, which is today, we have two interesting figures. One is Richard Baxter, the Protestant theologian in the late 17th century, a very unusual man. He, although very, very low Protestant, not Presbyterian, but very much an independent, he nonetheless acted as chaplain for the Royalist Army of Charles I, and he took a lot of grief for that. And in one of his sermons or essays, he used the phrase mere Christianity, which C.S. Lewis then picked up for his book, which has done so much good in the world.
Yes.
Also on the 12th is a very popular American entertainer from the early 20th century, Burt Williams. Mm. He was from the Caribbean. He was a black. He wasn't African-American. He was, well, actually, he was quite mulatto. And he had to wear blackface to perform his
stuff. Black guy's wearing a black face.
Because the conventions of his kind of humor involved being, you know, black with red lips or white lips, et cetera. It was just part of, it's like the stage Irishman or Sir Harry Lauder coming out with a kilt and a bottle of whiskey going, hee, 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 and telling Scottish jokes.
Mammy, how I love you, I love you.
Exactly. Well, Al Jolson, Al Jolson was white and Jewish doing that, but it was a little unusual to see Burt Williams.
Yeah.
He's immortalized in a poem of the great American poet Hart Crane, who he's watching signs go by from the train, and he says, see Burt Williams, what? You know, and it's a weird moment in Crane's poetry. Sometime we should talk more about Burt Williams. He has a hilarious comic song, which is called Death, Where Is Thy Sting, which I used to perform at parties.
Performed it. I'd love to hear that.
What you say is the positive truth. Oh, death, where is thy sting? Mm-hmm. If there's booze and women down below, the devil and I will put on a show, etc.
Yeah.
They don't write them like that anymore. Okay.
Hey, look at this. November 9th, Hedy Lamarr. You know who Hedy Lamarr
is. Yes, very beautiful, charming actress.
Yes.
Also a brilliant woman who was something of an inventor. She had something to do with code breaking. And as I recall,
really?
She also had something to do with the development of radar. Radar or sonar. No, I mean...
Beauty and brains.
She was not an airhead. Not an especially good actress, but really quite lovely, but way above standards of Hollywood beautiful women.
Well, you learn something new every day.
Yeah. Tomorrow has birthdays of two really great people. One of them, of course, is St. Augustine of Hippo, as opposed to the saint they call Austin of Canterbury. Mm. So Augustine of Hippo being one of the greatest writers of later antiquity. He was late 4th, early 5th century, and most famous for such works as The City of God,
yes,
the Civitas Dei, but also his Confessions, also lots and lots of sermons. Augustine was a very interesting person, very passionate, in his life. His mother, St. Monica, was a Christian. His father was a pagan. And Augustine was drawn toward various schools of philosophy, especially the Manichaean school, which said that life was an eternal struggle between the equally matched powers of good and evil. He was drawn more and more to Christianity, and it was meeting Ambrose in Milan where I believe the final conversion was effected. Of course, he went back to study, back to his town in North Africa, and unfortunately, his learning and his eloquence, because he was a teacher of rhetoric and quite a brilliant writer. I mean, atheists can read Augustine just for pleasure because he's such a beautiful writer. Although, by the way, I once knew this chump named Dinesh D'Souza, who was sort of a famous young conservative, and he wrote a book in which he said Augustine was fine, but his prose style was awful. So I asked him, I said, Dinesh, where did you get this idea? I mean, I didn't know you knew Latin. Well, I don't. I just read this 100-year-old translation. In other words, a translation in Victorian English had convinced poor D'Souza that Augustine couldn't write.
If only he studied Latin and learned Latin. If there was just somebody who had a course in Latin, wouldn't that be tremendous?
Perhaps on the internet.
Yes, even on our website. Coming to a website, your favorite website, near you, a course in Latin, Introduction to Latin.
By Jove, I think you've got it.
Yes.
The other thing that Augustine is most famous known for, other than his two great books, as well as things like De Doctrina Christiana on Christian teaching or his work on the Trinity, he was the great hammer against certain heresies like the Donatist heresy and the Pelagian heresy. And he was an early upholder of pure Christian orthodoxy against the challengers. Some of the challengers were not such bad people, but they were misled and they had to be rejected.
Now, he had struggles in his own life, and he, in Confessions, I believe, he talks about some of that. He was married for a while?
Well, it was somewhere between a common law marriage, and remember, Roman marriage was very restrictive, and you had to have property tie-ups. He called her a concubine, but they had a legal relationship, and he was required to support her and his son. The son died. Augustine treats this episode as if there's something shameful about it.
Right.
He is not among the great playboys of the world. He led a normal life, but even before he was a Christian, he was tormented by anxieties about his own shortcomings and his moral failings. I think Augustine has been very important in the conversion process of many Christians because you read Augustine and you realize he is not holier than thou.
No.
He is brilliant, learned. He had all this secular learning, which he never cast aside on the one hand, but for him, the truths of the gospel and the Christian tradition, it took precedence over his Cicero.
Would you say that Confessions or City of God, if you're going to read a book for starters, reading him, which one would be better?
You probably should start with the Confessions because the City of God is very long and you could read parts of it. It's a wonderful book. By the way, in the book I'm trying to finish now, Volume 1 of Properties of Blood, I actually have a long critique of some of his views because he overreacted after the sack of Rome in repudiating the Roman and Greek tradition. Hmm. And that's not typical of Augustine. He actually was much more well-balanced than that. That sack by Alaric the Visigoth seemed to people like Augustine and to St. Jerome, who wasn't there, neither one of them were there, it seemed to them to be the end of the world. Hmm. And Jerome has a famous letter saying, our world, our entire world is wrapped up in ruin.
Wow.
So it's a terrible
end of days kind of thing.
Yes, yes. But it's certainly a great joy to read.
So Augustine, he achieved sainthood. Was there something particularly that they said, oh, that guy should be a saint?
Well, in the early days of the church, you know, sainthood was sort of something that evolved naturally. They didn't put you on trial as they do now, nor do they have this factory process initiated by Pope John Paul II that seems to stamp out saints and martyrs in an assembly line, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
20,000 martyrs to communism here, bang, bang, bang. It's a little silly. The Orthodox process always struck me as somewhat better. The Orthodox, it always was a question of first you're developing locally as a saint and then more and more people acknowledge this. And finally, when the general opinion of Christians who have been touched by a particular person before or after death, when this becomes an overwhelming pressure, then people start talking about him as a saint. It's very informal,
okay. But
there's a lovely democracy about it. And so the trouble with what the Catholic Church does, you know, they make you a saint 1,000 years ago, and then people start having doubts, and before long, some wise guys kicking out St. Christopher and dozens of saints
Wow. Because
they don't have the record for them. Every tradition has its own. Remember this, Rex, you know, anybody in heaven is a saint. And therefore, most saints, we don't know who they are.
Mm.
But the saints that we celebrate are saints that have had particular impact on the life of the church, either because of their exemplary humility or charity or their devotion to the church itself, or because of their extraordinary learning, like in the case of St. Thomas Aquinas
Yeah. Or
some of the medieval saints. Saints come in every shape, size, and color, and some of them were quite difficult people to get along with. St. Jerome, for example, the translator of the Bible, the Vulgate translation, was not a very nice person to hang around with. They all had to have done extraordinary things during their lifetime. And usually these things are, and now they have a special rule whereby after death, somehow miracles have been wrought in their name or through their relatives.
Right, yeah. Okay.
It's the Western Church has always been a bit legalistic about this. The Eastern Church has been more taking these things as they come.
Good to know. Got anybody else?
Today also, one of my favorite English writers, although he's actually a Scotsman, Robert Louis Stevenson was born. Stevenson is best known, of course, for such books as Treasure Island and Kidnapped, two of the most extraordinarily entertaining books that have been written or published in the English language. But there are lots and lots of things. His Travels on a Donkey, which is a lovely travel book. He did a wonderful some travel essays about his trip as an immigrant, on an immigrant boat and an immigrant train across the United States. He didn't do this, you know, on a lark in order to get a commission from a publisher. His parents didn't want him to chase this woman he had met on a boat. She was a married woman who very unhappily married, and her husband was cheating on her, and Stevenson wanted to marry her. He followed her all the way out to California, but unfortunately he had tuberculosis and almost died in a California gold field till word got to her. She nursed him back to health, and she, her son, and Stevenson then went to live in Polynesia. Some of his other books, which he wrote, like The Wrong Box, which was made into a very funny movie in, I guess, the 1970s with Michael Caine and some extremely good actors. Hmm. The Wrong Box of brilliant books, as is the new Arabian Nights and the sequel called The Dynamiters. He really has an amazingly perfect prose style, one of the most melodious prose styles in English. He was something of a pessimist, and this bothered G.K. Chesterton about him. He has done so much good in the world. Unfortunately, people think of him as a children's writer, especially Treasure Island. I think Treasure Island is simply one of the four or five best pieces of fiction in English.
Wow.
And it can be read by somebody 8 years old or 80 years old and anything in between. I've read it four times. And the portrait of Long John Silver in the book, not in the movies. The movies sort of louse it up. In the novel, Long John Silver is one of the most extraordinary characters created. He's worthy to have been a character created by Shakespeare and better than Charles Dickens' character.
When you say melodious, how can a book read melodious?
Poetry, of course, has a melody, but very few people in modern English have been concerned with the melody of prose, the way the words are fit together so that they
sound
good.
But it's a novel. It's not a poem.
That's right.
But it's melodious.
In the ancient world, they understood that prose had to be written with a beautiful sound. And there's a famous essay of Dionysius of Halicarnassus. In Latin, it's known as De Compositione Verborum, on the putting together of words so that the sound, when the two words are joined together, is not ugly.
Well, we're going to have a show just on melodious novel writing and such. Skipping the poetry, I can understand poetry being melodious.
I was introduced to poetry when I was given a copy of A Child's Garden of Verses, which is an anthology of poems written for children by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Okay.
So they're quite beautiful. That's really the big people. There are a couple of little people.
Little people.
Day after tomorrow, the 14th, Ioannis Secundus. Ioannis Secundus was an interesting Neo-Latin poet. He wrote during the Renaissance, and he wrote a famous work of erotic poems called the Basia, the Kisses. By erotic, I don't mean pornographic.
Yeah.
I mean in the tradition of Latin love elegy, Tibullus, Propertius, Catullus, quite memorable stuff. And then one of my favorite 20th century writers, Carlo Emilio Gadda. Gadda was Italy's contribution to the avant-garde in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. Very unusual writer. He's the cousin of a friend of mine, and she kept on telling me about her cousin, Carlo Emilio Gadda, and I thought, yes, 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 we all have relatives.
Right.
And then I was walking by the Pinacoteca Brera one day in Milan, one of the great art museums of the world. And what have they got on their billboard outside but a celebration of the genius of one of Italy's great writers, Carlo Emilio Gadda.
Oh.
And then I got stuck actually reading a paper at a conference on Gadda. So he wrote the most difficult mystery novel ever written, whose title is something like That Ugly Mess on the Via Merulana. It is a very profound book, but it's written in three or four Italian dialects, and even Italians have trouble reading it. But scene after scene, it is powerful, reflective, deep, and he's not everybody's cup of tea. Most Italians won't read him because of the dialect thing.
Right.
There's an okay translation by William Weaver, who is a famous translator from Italian and from German, I believe. I think he did standard translation of Wagner's Ring, but Weaver's translation quite properly ignores the dialect question and just writes it. It's a readable novel in the translation, much easier than in Italian.
Huh. I've got one.
Okay.
See if you know who this guy is. Frederick Banting. He was born on the 14th, 1891. Might give it away. What do you think?
Well, I cheated because you brought it up and then I squeezed out of you. So let's be honest. I found it. He's the one who discovered the uses of
insulin
in treatment of diabetes.
That's correct.
This happened, in the early 20th century. The great populist politician, William Jennings Bryan, got a bit hefty. Again, a man from southern Illinois. And Bryan thought he could cure his diabetes with diet and exercise. The doctors tried to tell him to take, I think it was made from pigs at that
pigs.
Time.
Pigs, insulin from pigs.
Yeah, from the pancreas. Poor Bryan preferred to die, which I think not a good idea.
Not the best choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and take the insulin. But, you know, they say that diet and exercise can definitely help lose weight and take care of yourself.
For type 2 diabetes, yes. So that's probably what he had. For people born with diabetes, you don't take the insulin. You're pretty much a goner. Our younger daughter developed it at about roughly the age of 9. Huh. And we kept on thinking she just had a cold and then she didn't want to go to school. She was faking it. My wife took her to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, we'll run the tests, but we'll run them in the emergency room. I can tell you 99 chances out of 100, she's on the verge of death from diabetes.
Well, thank God for
and,
Mr. Banting.
He sent her straight to the emergency room. And
wow.
They couldn't even administer the insulin immediately. She was so dehydrated, they said insulin would have killed her, and they had to pump her up with fluid. Interestingly, we were feeling very guilty about this. The doctor said, listen, 9 out of 10 cases that he had run into of childhood type 1 diabetes, the diagnosis is always made in the emergency room. But
wow.
It's very touch
All
and go.
All of a sudden, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it, Rex.
Oh, okay. I thought you had another one.
No.
But anyway, November birthdays. Also coming up, we'd like to tell you about, we did another podcast concerning the, what's that book again you wrote there? What's that weird title?
The Politics of Human Nature.
Yes, part 2 is on the website now, and coming up is part 3. I think we're just going to continue with that. Lots of exciting things coming up. 1,000 Years of Jihad is a book for sale, and you can get that. That's really good stuff. I'd also like to mention the Shakespeare lectures from the symposium this year. A lot of really excellent lectures. I was editing them, and they are on the website and for sale as well. So enjoy everything that the Fleming Foundation has to offer.
And think of what great Christmas presents these would
Ooh,
make,
oh, oh.
Not to mention a gift membership.
That's a good one.